In the next 75 minutes, I'd like to talk a bit about two back-end technologies Microsoft is about to ship right after, well, maybe a few months after .NET 4 reaches the final stages. I'm going to talk about App Fabric. Now, App Fabric is some kind of an overloaded term because there are two very, very different versions of App Fabric. There is one which is the Windows Azure App Fabric. That's the complete cloud-based support system and infrastructure system which is running in Microsoft's operation centers, in Microsoft's data centers. And then there is App Fabric as part of Windows Server, which would officially be called Windows Server App Fabric, which is totally different. It is an application server extension to Windows Server 2008. So basically, what we are looking at is if you've been around for quite a while in the Microsoft space, then we're looking at something which is comparable to COM Plus, to the hosting environment which has been built to support COM components and to host COM components. We're looking at Microsoft's new application server at the end of the day. In App Fabric, you have two different features. There's a whole set of features around hosting components, hosting workflows, services, of course, and there is a distributed caching system. And I'll try to look into both during this session. In any case, you'll be able to find the slides and the code samples on www.thinktecture.com. There will be a link to conferences. And of course, you can always contact me at ingo.rammer@thinktecture.com if you've got any questions after this session. So what is Windows Server App Fabric? Well, as I've said, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about the hosting part, and we're talking about distributed caching. In the first part of this session, I'd like to look into App Fabric as a hosting environment. You'll see how you can use it to host your workflow services, your WCF services, without creating custom hosts, as you'd have to do today. And in the second part, I'd like to look into caching. In terms of time allotment, the second part will be slightly larger because it contains a lot more new code technologies and a lot more code-based infrastructure to show. The first part is just, it's like an IT pro's infrastructure. It is a lot of ready-made things which you can just install and run on your servers. Okay. So if you're writing a WCF service today or a workflow service today, what you have to do is one of the first things you will have to do actually is to create some kind of hosting environment or to decide for some kind of hosting environment. Yes, in theory, you could host your workflow services in IIS, for example, but in practice, this is quite a limited hosting environment because you give up control over your app domain's lifecycle because now IIS will control your lifecycle. And actually, you don't have the ability to auto-start your services, for example, to have them run during OS boot up, etc., because they will just be activated on demand as soon as somebody requests data from these services. You have no instance control, and the monitoring support is quite limited. Well, it's not really limited. It's just that the configuration is very hard. So then in practice, if I create my own workflow host today, it would be very hard to walk to my system operator, to my IT pro, to my admin, and say, "Oh, can you please turn on tracing for this and that workflow instance?" Because he'd have to go through a config file, he'd have to create a tracking profile, etc., just so that he would be able to give me the tracking information. In App Fabric hosting tries to solve a few of these things. Now, App Fabric hosting is today available as a beta 2. You can download this. It's compatible with the RC, with the release candidate of .NET 4 and of Visual Studio 2010. If you're still running on beta 1, on beta 2 of Visual Studio for whatever reason, you could try beta 1 of App Fabric just so you can get an idea of how these things work. In both cases, these tools will use a SQL Server database behind the scenes. This, of course, can be a SQL Express database, and it will be used on the hosting side for tracking information, for monitoring information, and for instance persistence if you decide to use it for workflow persistence. And these two databases can be created by the config tool. For the caching side, and these are actually two different products which are currently being merged. The hosting and the caching used to be separate, which also explains a few of these things. For the caching side, you have to create the database upfront, and you can only select the database, for example. But in any case, there's a config application, and this config application, well, at the end of the day, it just writes the global web.config for you. So after installing, and that's quite important, because after installing AppFabric Beta 2, it's not yet ready to run. You have to run a config application, which is, or let me just start zoom in first. You have to start a config application, which would be installed, and which is just called configure app config. And in the configuration for app config, you can configure a few things, or you need to configure a few things before you can use it. You need to configure hosting and or caching. Both of them are optional, so you can choose whatever you want. And in both cases, you need to pick the database you want to use to store this information. So let me just click through this. It's actually quite simple. You just enable the services you want to use from AppFabric hosting. If you want to use monitoring, you can then determine a monitoring provider, which would just be a SQL server in most cases. And in configure, you can then select a connection string to this database. That's very common. Same thing happens for persistence. This will create two different databases, one for tracking, one for persistence. And in caching services, it's very similar. If you're using caching services, you would activate the cache configuration, pick again your connection string to your SQL Server instance. And in caching, you then have to select whether or not you want to create a new cluster, a caching cluster, or whether you want to join a cluster. And I'm going to talk about caching and clustering in just a second. The important thing here is just that these are steps which you have to do before you can use AppFabric. This is not done directly during installation, but you can do this later on. And you can also add more connection strings later on, for example, just by rerunning this tool. Okay, yes, we can definitely lose these changes. Okay, and what this tool does is it writes something to your web.config. That's important because this also means that you could do the same things manually. It just writes these the SQL connection strings to your app, to your global web config in your framework directory. After installing this, you can, and after configuring this, you can start to use AppFabric hosting in your deployments or in your development. Today, AppFabric hosting runs on Windows Server 2008 and on Windows 7 as a deployment platform. I haven't tried it on Vista. I think it will also work on Vista, which would be the same kernel base. Okay. That's the interesting thing now. How do you manage your services? Well, everything's done in IIS management. So you just start your IIS manager. Oops, let me just full screen this. And it just works the way it worked before. You would create a new site, which is not a website now. It's like a hosting site. But you configure it basically in the same way as you configure a website. You configure a base directory, for example. That's important because all the configuration also happens in the same way as you do it for a web environment. You have a web config. You can use virtual directories, etc. Okay, and you can set base URLs and just like the host header matching. In the new things which come with AppFabric are located in managed WCF and WF services and some parts in the new deployment scheme. So if you create a Visual Studio application, a workflow application today, and let's just do this. I'll just start Visual Studio. That's the release candidate. Important for you, if you download the release candidate and if you install the release candidate today, there are three different additional updates which you have to install or which you should install because there were some bugs in the handling of IntelliSense which would crash Visual Studio quite frequently. But as soon as you install these three additional patches, and you can just Google for I don't know, Visual Studio 2010 RC patch, and there are a few knowledge base articles, you can install them, and it gets reasonably stable. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll just open a workflow service, which I've just created using file new workflow service project. Essentially, the type of project is just file new, and you have workflow. And this is just a WCF workflow service application you're looking at. I've just pre-created this. And it's not massive, there's no big magic in it. And it's just a very simple service. There's just a receive operation which will trigger this service, and I'll use an assign. Well, I get some input parameter, I'll increment it by one, and in the send response, I'll just send it back. These are just regular workflow 4 constructs, so you can now just simply send and receive messages in workflow 4. There were similar things in workflow 3, which would allow you to host your workflow inside of the classical ASP.NET web services. So these are just our input parameters. As soon as I compile this workflow, the system will create a WCF service around this workflow. It will automatically derive the interface from the operation name and from the content. That's something which is rather unusual in the service environment because I define my parameters. In here, in this case, I just specified that there is one parameter called parameter 1. It's an int32, and I'll store the value in the workflow variable input value. Now, and all these parameters will now define my workflow interface. Currently, there is unfortunately no way to say I want to implement this specific interface or this specific operation contract, which is the way in you'd normally think about workflow interfaces in a WCF environment. But okay, you define your interfaces, and after this, you can set the in properties. You can set. Oops, that's not what I wanted. I want to scroll down further in properties. In package publish web, you can create a deployment package. And again, it's very similar to how the web environment worked. So basically, if you scroll down, you can say that you want to create your deployment package as a zip file, as a single zip file. You put in the location of your zip file. You define the default website or hosting site or a virtual directory or virtual application. It's all basically all the same. And you define your application name, which should be used inside the deployment scenario. Okay, and after this, you can compile your application and you can right-click it and you can, There should be a create deployment package in a second. Is it on the, oh, it's on the solution. No, it should be on the project. I need to scroll up, here we go. Okay, there's a build deployment package. This will create your single zip file. Let me just do this, and it will run, it will create my zip file. But that's basically the development part. As soon as you're ready to move this into production, or as soon as you're ready to move this into another system, you take your zip file and import it in the new Dublin, in the new Fabric hosting environment. Dublin used to be the code name for this before. And you can do this just by using deploy import package. Import application and browse to it, select the application, which in my case would be packages, and in package it would be just my O1 workflow service package. Next. That's the name we specified in our project, demo1. And I'll just click next, finish. Okay, I could change the config here. The administrator doesn't have to import all the settings you selected. The administrator will just get an option. Okay, but at the end, your project appears as a virtual application in your root. If you click the application, you will see that there are a few more sections here, and that's essentially what you'll get from AppFabric Hosting. These are the things hosting gives you. You get a dashboard, which allows you to view the current situation, the current, live information of your service. You'll see which instances are running, how many requests they're handling, etc. So you get tracking and monitoring information. For workflows, it also allows you to show the state of each workflow. Are there workflows which are faulted, etc.? The dashboard will also be your primary entry point for viewing any kind of logging or tracing information. That's where you'll enter the system. Behind the scenes, all these things will just create queries towards your SQL database. So you can always query this information also from a regular SQL client. So if you look at the AppFabric dashboard, it will just takes a few seconds to generate information. And you'll see, for example, that there are no persistent workflow instances, there are no suspended, no idle instances, etc. We've just created this service. Okay. So that's your dashboard. What you'll get in addition is when you right-click the application or the site and the virtual application, you'll get configuration for this, which would be in Manage WCF and WF Services. And that's where you get configuration for the individual aspects of hosting. So the dashboard is your runtime view, and this is your config view. You can configure various things, monitoring, tracking, etc., persistence. And, well, you can, for example, even configure things like whether or not you want to enable metadata requests, WSDL requests over HTTP. If you are a WCF developer today, then you know that it's not very hard, but this is something which you simply have to do in your web.config or in your application config today. In App Fabric hosting, an administrator can select these. So in development, you can continue to use basically your same config, but as soon as you deploy it, your administrator can change settings. They can disable things like this. It's also so that your administrator can, for example, now configure the throttling behavior of a WCF or a workflow service. Because all these things, also the deployment and the creation of the SIP package, work in the same way for WCF services and for workflow services. Okay, what else can you configure? Well, if you are running a workflow service, you can select a persistence provider, which would be one which we've created with the tool beforehand. Same for host management. You can, for example, tell Workflow to automatically unload instances after a certain time frame to scale better under highly loaded environments. Okay, but that's just configuration, which today you'd have to do in a web config or in an app config. And with App Fabric hosting, an administrator can do decoupled from the development work. So if we go to our service, for example, let's just start this service. And I just start this so that it runs in a WCF test client. Actually, I'll start it so that it runs in Dublin. This is just our test client. If you just hit F5 in Visual Studio, this is what you'll see. This will not run in Dublin. That's very important. It's just the same as it used to be in web development. This will run inside of a small hosted web server. It will not run inside of Dublin. And it tells you that this is running on localhost 14300, for example. Actually, I want to run this on dublintest.local, which would be a DNS name I gave my local service, /demo01 service XAMLX. Let's just download the WSDL. And in just a second, it should continue. Oh, Dublin Est. This was a typo, just a typo on my side. Do I still get my Dublin test? This would be the one. Demo 01, nope, that's the one. Demo 1 service XAMLX Dublin test. Okay, this should be the one. Yeah, okay. Now I'll remove the first one again. And this is just a test client for our service. So if I call the service, I'll just set some parameter. I'll send parameter 5 and invoke the service. And it will return back. That's just very simple. That's just what we did. But the important thing here is that I just wanted to show you how to trigger a service to show what you can see inside of the dashboard now. Because in the dashboard, what you'll see is that there is one idle instance. The reason is that I've created a delay after replying back, just so that we can see it. And you can then browse this. You can click on your idle instances. You can say, oh, I want to see details over this instance. Oh, it's finished already. It wasn't idle long enough. Let's see if we can get it. Okay, it's not idle anymore. We need to do this faster. And here we go. There should be one idle instance now in a second. There's even an active one right now. And it should go idle in just a second. And here it is, idle. I can click it. This is an idle one. And then you can continue to browse this. You can say, I want to show the tracked workflow instances. I want to show the tracking events from this workflow. And it's too fast. It's already closing this one. I've configured this now so that it's not keeping old instances. Like, that's just a config setting. You can say keep completed instances or delete them. In my case, I deleted them. Okay, in any case, you'd normally see the individual workflow activities which have been executed by this workflow. You can get timing information for every single activity. Depending on the on your configuration for tracking. So in here, for example, for monitoring, you can select different monitoring levels. Health monitoring gives you only coarse-grained monitoring, but you can set this to debugging or troubleshooting, as they call it here, and then you get very detailed information about every single activity. If you use WCF services, or in general, for all these services, you can also activate file-based logging, which would be your regular WCF end-to-end logging. But you can change and activate all these things in the user interface. You can also, after configuring a service, you can go to deploy export application and export the complete configuration of a package. It's really just like COM+ used to be. Before COM+, you had to write your own hosts for DCOM, etc. And then in COM+, you had this ready-made host, which allowed you to create packages, use them for deployment, and that's what you'll get from AppFabric again. It's very similar if you've known this old environment. Okay, so what have we seen? Well, we've seen that you'll get configuration for monitoring, tracking, persistence, etc. for all these database-based services. You get a dashboard, which allows you to drill into the monitoring events. You get auto-start capabilities. That's just something which you can check in the management screen for your certain application. You can say, I want to auto-start this service. This means that when your operating system boots, it will automatically launch the service. The service won't wait for the first connection, but it will immediately run the application on start in global ASAX. This is something developers have asked for quite a long time. Because, I don't know, yes, please.
One question, if you can set auto start, then typically what you're placing in Windows services, theoretically you can move here now?
Exactly, that's a good question. So if you can do auto start, then can you move the things which until now we'd have to do Windows services for, can we move them in this place? And exactly, that's right. That's the reason for this one. So that we, because in the past, especially if you look at workflow services, we used to do a lot of Windows services just so that we can get a well-defined startup behavior. But we had to live with the fact that we have to manually create this. We didn't get config UI, etc. Now you get config UI and you get system startup behavior. Okay. So this was the first part, the hosting part. As I said, it was not very code-driven because most of these things were common. We are just doing, Microsoft is just unifying a few ideas from the past, a few ideas from IIS, and unifying them with Dublin. And of course, the hosting here, Dublin is the application server code name again. The hosting here is done not just for HTTP protocols. It's done for all the protocols supported by the WCF, because it's also integrating parts of WAS, of the Windows Activation Service. So it's really just about putting things together which have existed independently and merging them so that a developer and IT pro can work with these things as a single package. Caching is different. Caching is new. Caching is something Microsoft hasn't offered before, at least not in this way. Microsoft, also about 10 years ago, tried to do something in the COM world with an IMDB, an in-memory database, which didn't work out quite well because it actually didn't address the problems at this time. Now we're looking at something which is distributed caching. So if you look at AppFabric caching and you just want a 30-second summary, then AppFabric is an environment which is, well, a collection of Windows services part of AppFabric, which allows you to combine multiple physical nodes into one big logical cluster, one big logical cache. So you can go beyond the limits of single hardware, both in terms of scaling, in terms of size, but also in terms of availability, because you can configure a cache so that, or cached items so that they will be mirrored on multiple nodes, for example. The first thing I need to do now is to start the virtual machines, because caching or distributed caching is something you can't really demonstrate on a single box. So I just start a number of virtual machines here. I'll talk later about the logical environment I'm using here. And let's switch back here in the meantime. Okay. Now, what's the use case for Velocity? And that's very important because it's really geared towards one very specific use case or a family of use cases. If you look at a regular web application today, it will look more or less like this. At the front, you'll have some kind of load balancer. Quite likely, you have multiple load balancers for availability. You have a number of web servers, maybe a number of application servers behind them, and they'll hit some kind of data store. That's the way we've done web applications for, I don't know, 15 years or whatever. Now, if you look at the memory situation in one particular server, you basically see that on one part, you have, of course, yes, your application code, your internal application memory, the memory you need during processing your requests. You will have, or you maybe have, session state information in your individual servers. Now, session state is already very tricky. I'm coming back to this in just a second. And then you'll have local caching on the individual server. That's how most web applications look like today. If you create web apps, I think this might be very much what you're seeing in your day-to-day business. Okay, is this a problem? Well, it's not really a problem. We've been doing this for years, and it used to work. But there are two areas where we could improve things. And to be fair, Microsoft's distributed caching is not the first distributed caching product. There are things like Memcached in the open source world on different platforms, which do the same thing. Because people have realized that there is a need for distributed caching. It's just that App Fabric caching is Microsoft's implementation of these distributed caching ideas. Okay, but why do we need distributed caching in the first place? Well, if you look at regular web applications today without distributed caching, there are two areas. One is the discussion about session state, and that's a discussion you'll do or you'll see on every single project. It is, do we use session state? How can we configure your load balancer so that it allows sticky sessions, or do we put the session state in the database so that we don't have to use sticky routing, or do we use an out-of-process session server to keep our session information so that we don't have to hit the database for every single request? And these are the trade-offs you have to make today. If you store the session state in memory, you can't fail it over, for example. You can't use sticky sessions. You have to use sticky sessions. The same or a similar question comes up with caching, with in-memory caching. If you cache in memory today in a load-balanced environment, you have to make sure that your cache is consistent after you perform updates on your data. If I'm shopping at Amazon and if I change my shopping cart because I'm adding a new book to my shopping cart, then, well, Amazon would have to sync this information if they'd cache it on multiple nodes. All the individual nodes in their cluster would have to have the same information. Now, Amazon is avoiding this problem because they introduced one click, so I'm never using the shopping cart in the first place. But normally, you'd have to do this. And if you run, even if you just provide a second machine for failover capabilities, you'll have to sync the cache between, because my second request could hit the other machine, which should not present me with stale data. Distributed caching works in a different way. In distributed caching, both of these problems can be mitigated by infrastructure. It works based on the idea that instead of creating individual caches, we create one big cluster and over all our web servers, maybe even over a number of additional cache servers, which don't really act as web servers, but which just act as purely as cache servers. So you just say, well, instead of every server spending 4 gigs of its memory for local caching, let's just pool these 4 gigs and do one and create one big virtual cache. To do this, you have to install App Fabric and the caching module of App Fabric on each of these servers. And, you have to configure App Fabric. The initial configuration of App Fabric is done using this tool, using the configure App Fabric tool, which you have to run after the setup of App Fabric, just so that you can select which SQL server is used for storing infrastructure information. Again, that's important because in the SQL server, you will not find the cached items. The cached items are in memory. In SQL server, you only find information about the cached nodes. So there's basically just one big table which says, oh, we have these nodes in our cache. These are the physical machines which are part of our cache. You can, or you could also opt to not put this into SQL server, but to put this into an XML file. For load balancing and for high availability, SQL Server is recommended because you can cluster your SQL Server instance. So even if your SQL Server fails over, it's easy to fail the config over. Okay. And now we'll get into the sample environment. As of now, I think my virtual machine should have started. Let me just check this. Otherwise, I need to continue talking. And the virtual machine needs to be powered on. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Great. Okay. So what we are seeing here is you're actually looking at a simulation of 5 different machines as of today. There is one which is my notebook directly. On my notebook computer, I run IIS. On Windows 7, I run Visual Studio, etc. My client application, well, client in terms of the cache, it's still a web application, will run on my notebook machine. And then I'll have a virtual machine which acts as a domain controller and which hosts the SQL Server, and a number of virtual machines which just are acting as cache nodes. So they are they're not running IIS. Well, I think it is installed, but I'm not using it, and they are just running as cache instances. But we're looking at 5 different simulated machines. In these 5 machines, let's just see. Oh, it's still starting a VM, still slowing down my machine. The problem is running 5, or actually 4 virtual machines on a laptop computer is something which is a bit taxing for the computer. Here we go. And that's why I tried to start up the environment before. Let's see if my computer starts to return again. It does something. Let's see what the status of our virtual machines is. Okay, this one is running. They should be running in just a second. I couldn't start this before because I wanted to show you this other sample in Dublin where I wanted to start Visual Studio. Normally, I should have closed Visual Studio before starting this because memory is really the problem here. Okay, so let's go. This one is running now, and I think I can kill my Visual Studio instance. Let's just kill it directly. Oh, there are even 2 of them running. Kill this one and kill that one. And how does our performance numbers look like? It's okay. It has 200 megs free. That's fine. That's our DC, and these are the cache instances. Now, you configure AppFabric caching using PowerShell. That's something I had to get used to. I don't know if Microsoft's planning to release a UI administration tool for this, but as of today, you have to administer it using PowerShell. In PowerShell, you have a number of commands for this. One of them, let me just select this one, would be get cache help. This gives you information about all the commands which are supported in the caching system. You can also, let me just resize this a bit. Okay. And you can also run get help on each of these commands. So I can say get help new cache, for example, which then tells you more about the new cache command. But that's regular PowerShell stuff. But the important thing is there is a PowerShell admin, and unfortunately PowerShell is as of today the only administration environment. What you do with the PowerShell is you can create, and that's the first thing you'll have to do, you can create caches. A cache is something, a named cache is something you will use to store items in. So basically, we'll take our whole virtual environment based off these 4 virtual machines and the memory which they share. And of course, that's an irony to run this in a virtualized environment because, normally you'd run this on physical boxes, of course. But now we have this big memory segment for all these 3 machines. And if you create a named cache, you will create a logical separation, a logical partition of this memory, and that's something you'll use to store your items in. And they will be distributed amongst these different nodes. You can create more than 1 cache, and all these caches can be configured in different ways. And I'm coming back to the configuration properties in just a few minutes. But now you have something which you can refer to by name. So there is a cache called session data in my system, which I can use to store session information, for example. Okay, before you can, as you've seen, you can administer it using PowerShell. To use it in PowerShell, you first have to import a certain module using import module distributed cache administration. This loads the PowerShell library for cache configuration. And after this, you have a few commands which are important. You create a new cache using the new cache command. You can start the cluster using start cache cluster, and you get information by using get cache host. These will be the most important commands. So for example, if I go to my PowerShell and if I say get cache host, it will give me the current information, the current status information about my hosts. So for example, let me just zoom this. It will tell me that there are three different hosts, cache hosts running, and the service status is up for all of them, so all of them are currently reachable, and you get version information, which we don't need right now. Okay, but so that's how you get information. And after installing the cache on all these nodes, you have to manually call start cache cluster at some point in time, which fires up the cache initially. And after this, you can just, or it will just be started using Windows services. But initially, you have to tell each node that you are now done configuring the node and you want to start these nodes. Okay. And then you can call get cache to get information about the currently cached items, which as of now will be empty. So it just tells us that there are three caches. The default cache exists right after installation. I've created one cache which is called notifiable. I'm coming back to this later on, and one which is called session data. So we're using three different caches here in our sample. Microsoft has this drive today to make systems secure by default. That is, you can only access the cache if you're currently running in the same domain, if your user can be authenticated. You also have to go to your AppFabric config, to PowerShell, and add the user accounts, or the service accounts, actually, which can access your cache. In a lot of systems which we work on, the deployment scenario is slightly different in the web environment compared to the internet environment. In the web environment, you'll often see DMC-based deployments which run outside a domain, for example. And there won't be any outside users having access to the cache servers. So you might want to run AppFabric caching without this built-in security check. Also, security is something which costs in terms of runtime performance. And if you decide that this is running behind two firewalls anyway, then you might want to turn this off. Of course, you have to live with all the consequences. That's something which cannot be purely done in PowerShell. Instead, you have to export the config in PowerShell. Then you get an XML file. You can then change or add this advanced property, security properties, mode none, protection level none. And you can then re-import the cache config using the import cache config command. This would allow you to disable the security checks. Again, you have to live with this. I'm disabling it here because my notebook is not part of my virtual domain. Okay, let's go to the AppFabric Hello World. How do you access the cache? The first thing you do is you have to configure it. You could do this using code as well, but if you run it in config, here's what you'll do. The first thing is you'll add a config section for data cache client by just copying this configuration information. And after this, you can configure your data cache client. You basically do this by specifying one or more known host names and the security property. Now, the known host names, it's really just information you know at the time of your application startup. You basically specify that it could be this or that cache host. You don't have to specify all of these cache hosts, but it doesn't matter if you specify more than one cache host, it doesn't matter if all of them are running, for example. This is really just used by the client to find at least one cache host which is currently up and running. So you don't have to keep this 100% in sync with your real deployment, but you just see these servers as kind of your rendezvous points. These are well-known servers which are available when your client starts. The client will then try to contact each of the listed servers, and as soon as it can reach one server out of your cluster, it will ask the server for the current cluster configuration, because every server in the cluster knows which other machines are currently up and running, and it will go to this and say, now please give me the current information, which nodes are really running in my system. So you don't have to keep these consistent. And to use AppFabric caching, you'll add a reference to a few DLLs which are placed in C Windows System 32 AppFabric, and which would be Microsoft Application Server caching.client and caching.core. And the important thing is they have to be copied You cannot directly reference them from this directory. You have to copy them to your solution or at least to some other location. Okay, and after this, it's a case of newing up a data cache factory. You can then call get cache on the factory to get a data cache instance. This is now the logical reference to this cache, to this virtual cache which we've created. And you can store any value which is serializable. This should be anything serializable in one line. Of course, that's part of the comment serializable here. And to store something, you just call put, cache.put key value. It's like a big dictionary which is split amongst these different nodes in your cluster. That's just how you can view it. It's really just a very, very big key value pair in which the value has to be serializable so that you can actually move it to some other machine. Everything else is just managed for you. I'm going to show you this in a second. To access a cache item, you can just, again, use dictionary-like syntax. You just access the item using square brackets. There are, yes, please.
Can you put anything in there?
Excuse me?
Anything in there?
Can you put anything in there? As long as it's serializable, you can put it in there. It's, well, yeah. So that's the only thing. You have to optimize this, or you can optimize this, for example, if you say, well, you want to pre-serialize maybe things and only store a byte array because, you know, serialization is quite costly, and if you serialize, deserialize more often than you'd need to, then this could be negative for your performance. And I'm just mentioning this because we have a number of clients working in high-throughput applications where we talk about something like 300,000 pieces of information per second which they have to process. And now serialization, deserialization would kill these systems. In this case, we often use pre-serialization and only look at things in their byte array form and then use classical binary formatting techniques to say, well, give me the first 10 bytes and have a look at these 10 bytes before we decide whether or not to serialize or deserialize this. So you could also store a byte array here. Okay. Now, if you do this, what's happening behind the scenes is, at the beginning, very, very simple. Again, that's our environment. We have a number of caches here. We have our virtual machines or our physical machines. As soon as you call put, let's say you have a product somewhere, which you get from get product, which is serializable, and you call put on the cache, what's happening is the cache is using the key you're specifying here and the currently existing runtime information, information about which caches are alive, etc., to find out, based on this key, I should store this item on server one, for example. If you store multiple items, it will again determine for each and every single item which node should be used to store this this particular item. You can imagine this just as a starting point, as a very simple get hash code and modulo number of servers. Of course, it's more complex than this, but it's just to get a starting mental model. So it's really just using the cache, and the client knows, using the key, and the client knows, based on the key, which server will be used to host this this key. That's very important, because this means that the cache access time is constant. It doesn't matter which cache you're using. The access time will always be constant. It's just a single request. The client will not go, and when you call a put operation, the client won't just go to a single, I don't know, entry point host and tell the entry point to find out where to store this, but the client will know immediately which server it has to contact. This allows you to scale the cache, to scale the cache in a very simple way. You don't have to take any single point of failure considerations into account, but you can just scale the cache nearly linearly because the client's making the decision directly. If you want to scale the cache, for example, in the dimension of size, you can just add more machines. And this is really, this is literally, this is linear, because you just add more memory and it will just work. You can scale it on throughput by just adding more machines. Throughput just means the effort of serializing, deserializing on the server side to put something in the server's memory. And if you notice that your cache servers are getting too slow for your application, you can add more cache servers to distribute the load. Again, the client's making the decision, so you're looking at a nearly linear scaling pattern here, which is very important. And then there is a third thing which you can use to scale or to improve the throughput, and this is a concept called local cache. A local cache is an additional caching layer which does not live distributed in your data center, but which lives directly on the client side. This is like your regular old caching system, your local in-process caching. But it's done transparently. You can configure a certain cache to use a local cache in addition to the global cache. And when you do a read request, it will try to read it from the local first. If the item doesn't exist in a local cache, it will contact the cluster and will then store the item in the local cache. This gives you massively higher throughput. I mean, these are a few orders of magnitude. We are talking about something like 10 to 100 times faster, at least, compared to remote access. Maybe even 1,000 times, because you don't have a network access, you don't have serialization, deserialization. The drawback is that these items will get older, of course, because they are now cached in two different places. They are cached globally and locally. There are ways to synchronize them, but all these ways will be, there will always be a slight time delay between the change in the global cache and the notification to your local machine. I talked about the routing before, the item routing, or about the fact that the client knows where to place an item. So if you look at a client, every client will have a dynamic routing table. It builds this table as soon as it can contact a single machine in the cluster. That's what it does at startup. It goes through your list of registered hosts and tries to contact them. As soon as it contacts one of them, as soon as it can reach one of them, it will build an internal routing table. So when you call put on your cache, it will know exactly that it has to store this on some kind of server. It will put it directly on the server. If you look at multiple items, for example, they will end up at different places. Always linear. The request is always linear. We know exactly right from the start which server to contact. If a node fails, and that's the important thing here, we talk about distributed caching, which means node will fail over time and can fail at any time in your cache. As soon as a node fails, what's happening is the following. Let's just assume that your client now wants to read the item product 1, which was on our failed cluster node. So this item doesn't actually exist anymore. Our client does not know yet that the first instance is down, so it will try to reach this instance. It will get into a timeout, or the network will notify the fact that the system is not available anymore. At this point in time, the client tries to connect or tries to go to, well, the client knows that its routing table is outdated, it's stale, and it basically says, well, I don't know anything about the current situation of the world, so I'll have to get some additional knowledge. It contacts the next server it knows and asks the server, hey, do you know the current situation of our cluster? Do you know which nodes are up? And this server will then reply with the information that, yes, these two are up at this current point in time. The client will get this information back, will figure out based on this new information about the cluster topology, which node will now host the requested item, which node is now the owner of product 1. Let's say this could be Velocity Server 2, for example. And it will then contact this server and ask it for this particular item. If the server, as it is the case in this instance, does not have the item, it will just return null. Just like every cache request would, as soon as the item is not there, you'd get a null. So whenever you use App Fabric caching, this is going to be your standard pattern. App Fabric is a so-called cache-aside caching system, which means it runs aside of your regular database access, just like the ASP.NET caching. You try to get your item from the cache. If it's not in the cache, you'll try to get it from the database, and then you have to put it in the cache. There are alternative concepts in caching, like a cache-through system, where you just go to some infrastructure point and say, give me this product, and your cache will get the product or will automatically download this from your database. In Velocity, in App Fabric caching, if you want to achieve this, then you can create this, but you'd have to do this manually using a logic similar to this one. You try to get the item. If it's null, then you'll get it from your original store. Okay. And yes, of course, you put it into the cache. And from this point on, the cache is live again. This item is cached again. Should this cluster get online again, or this item get online again, the systems will detect this, and they will remove this old copy of the item because they know that the other one is more current, and they'll keep the current version of the item. Okay. There are a number of additional things which you can do with the cache item. It's not just put and get, but you can create regions, for example. You can put items in a region. Actually, I was a bit lying to you before. It's not the cache key which is used to determine which cluster or which node an item lives on, but the region key. It's just that by default, if you don't specify an explicit region, the cache key and the region will be handled together. Now, if you look at regions, let's just start my Visual Studio instance here. I've got a few demos for caching. The problem with caching is that I could show you a lot of demos, but it's really not fun because I just do puts and gets on the cache. The API is really very limited based on the fact that it's just a caching system, so you don't have a massive API. You've seen the first part, which would be get and put. And if you look at regions, for example, let me just show you this demo first in the web form, in the way the user would see it. This would be cache demo.local. This is now accessing our cache. And, well, let's just start this with the simple demo. We have a simple demo where I can store values, key test value test 1. I'll store this, key test 2, value test 2, and I'll store this as well. And I can then retrieve it using get, and I'll get my different items from the cache. Okay, that's very simple. That's what you've seen before. In the simple demo, if you click the button, first in page load, it will just create the factory and get a reference to this particular cache using get cache. And I'll call put to use key and value. And I call get, which would be the alternative syntax to angle brackets, to square brackets, to get the item back, which I can then cast to the real type and display it. To remove an item, I could also call cache.remove. Now, if we run this, we can go to our caching servers, and we can specify or send a get cache command. And now you see that there are things in our cache. Before this, that's the old view on top. We had the information that there was a cache default which was empty. And now we have a cache default which has a number of regions. And as I said at the beginning, you can imagine if you don't specify a region, then your key is also used as the name of the region. So we get two default regions. These are the two items, the test and the test 2 item. Both of them live on virtual cache 03 at this point in time, so they're living on the same server. So let's try if we can store some more items, test 3, test 4, so that we can get something into other servers. Okay, now we have a few more items. And again, these two items were stored on cache 3, and we have items on cache 1 and on cache 2. And let's just, well, right now the item, the original one, the test, would be stored on cache 3, so if I get this, it would get the value from cache 3. So if I go to cache 3, or if I just do a stop cache host, and I'll stop vcache 03, and the port is 22233. So I just take this machine out of the cache cluster. If I do a get cache host, of course, you'll see that this one is now down. It's now marked as down. And if I do a get cache, it takes a while because it now needs to figure out again which items are currently available. Now the cluster knows exactly which items are alive, which servers are alive. We only have these two items left because we lost everything which was on node 3. And if I go to my web again, and if I try to retrieve this value now, I just call it get, I'll get it back as empty. And I can now store it again. And this item used to live on cache server 3, and now it's living on either 1 or, it's now living on cache server 1. But these things are happening behind the scenes. If cache server 3 gets back online again, the information will be synchronized again, and the client will know where to and how to retrieve these items. But you won't get a failure here. You just get an empty item. Your client doesn't know that you've just lost part of your cache. It's just not there. Now, if you add regions to this, you can, let's just look at the demo first. Let's go back to our starting. If you look at regions, I'm referring to a cache which doesn't exist. So let's just go back to our sample. And I used to do this on a secured cache, so that I'm just changing the cache name back to default here. And in this case, you can specify a region name, a key, and a value. This is region 1, key 1, and value 1. And I'll store this item. And this will now end up, again, somewhere on one of those two cache items, which are alive, or on one of these two cache nodes. And here we say, well, there is a region called region 1. And this is the primary copy of this region. And I'm going back to this primary and secondary in just a second. To do this, you can use create region to create a region in the cache if it doesn't already exist. And as a third parameter on put, you can specify the region to put items in. Why would you do this? Why would you use a region? Because you can call get objects in region to do a bulk get. This means that you can do one round trip to get all the items which are in this region. Why would you use this? Well, just imagine that you're using a session state provider. And you have a session state internally is, again, another dictionary inside of your inside of this big cache item. So what you could do is you could store or use a session state so that you can, when reading the state, retrieve the complete region in one update, in one round trip. But when you change individual items, you would only send the individual changes back to your server. Okay, so, and you could also do a bulk delete. You can delete the complete session, and all the items in the region will be removed. Now, what is important when we're talking about caching? In all cases, whenever you cache data, and this is extremely important, and if, let's say, if you're doing anything with distributed caching, there are a number of answers which you have to provide. And the first one, if this is done incorrectly, then your application will fail. It might produce inconsistent results, etc. So this is very important. You have to, for every single piece of data which you think about caching, you have to find out, and it's quite easy because it's mainly about three different categories, and you have to find out which category your item fits in. Is this reference data you're looking at? Is this data which never, well, or hardly ever changes? Is this data which can become stale over time, but which you don't really mind if it's stale or not? Usually these are things like your product list, your price list, things which change over time. Yes, they might change, but when you're changing a price list today, you already know that this price list will change tomorrow. So it's not an as of now update. It's not an immediate update, but it's something which you can prepare in advance. It's a price list valid from the 1st of April 2010, for example. Okay. This would be the easiest form. You can easily cache these in most cases. Your data could also be activity data. This is data which is totally different. This is data which is accessed mainly by one user, but which has a lot of updates. This is your shopping cart. This is your session state. In addition, these are things which you might not be able to reconstruct from your database. This is your web application's data. You might or might not be able to reconstruct this. In a lot of cases, you might not be able, especially if you're looking at a shopping cart, for example. If you don't put it in a database, in addition to putting it in the cache, then you would not be able to reconstruct this data. And then you have resource data. Resource data is the most critical data. Resource data is data which is updated quite frequently, but by multiple users, maybe even by users not going through your caching system, but by third-party systems, like an inventory level. If you are caching, if you're accessing an SAP system to get a current inventory level, and you put this data in your cache, then SAP won't notify your cache. It will just, your data will get stale. And after doing this analysis, you can then make decisions based on the kinds of data. You can decide which kind of performance do you need for this data. If you're looking at catalog data, at product data, at price list data, you quite likely want very high performance because that's the data which your website reads all the time. And the read is happening more, way more often than any change in this data. Do you need consistency? Is it okay if your system is eventually consistent, or does it always need to be consistent? Amazon, for example, tells me on their website, they say, oh, there's one item in stock. And is there one item in stock at this point in time? Well, actually, we don't know. Because I'm a very frequent Amazon user, and when I click on, it happened to be twice so far, so they are pretty consistent, but not 100%. Twice I got an item, I got an order confirmation from Amazon telling me that they're going to ship the item, and about 15 minutes later, I get an email telling me that, oops, we are sorry, we were wrong. The item is not actually in stock anymore. And that's what Amazon is doing. They are using eventual consistency. They can't figure out if they're consistent right now, but they'll figure out at the later point in time. And they apologize because they made a decision. They said, well, if we want to guarantee consistency right from the start, atomic consistency, then we have to invest a whole lot more into our hardware than if we do eventual consistency. And then they made a business decision. They said, well, how much is it going to cost us if we're not consistent? And they figured that, well, the only cost they'd have is that they'd have to apologize for not being able to send the item. They might make a few customers mad at them, but then they figured, well, if we can squeeze this to a 15-minute time window, then maybe our customers won't be that mad at us. So they really made business decisions there to get their hardware costs down. The next question is, could you recover these pieces of information? If you're not able to recover this, if you, let's say, have a session state or if you have a shopping cart in your session state, then you'll have to somehow make sure that this is highly available, that you have some kind of failover strategy. I'm going to cover this in a second. And this also ties to availability. What happens if a certain node fails? What happens if this item just disappears from your cache? And these are the questions which you'll have to answer before even going into distributed caching, actually before even going into local caching. Oh, there's still a German version. Oh, nobody has seen this one? Okay, this was the newest version of this talk was given in, I gave it in Germany just 3 weeks ago, and I translated this one back. That's always the problem. You have the same talk and you translate it. German, you fix it. Or you add more information. Translate it back to English, add more information. Translate it back to German. Yeah, you have to translate it back to German. You had a version in German, but this was, well, slightly outdated. So you can choose whether or not you want to fix language bugs or factual bugs, and I'd rather fix language bugs while on stage. Okay, factual bugs are problematic. If I get the API wrong here, and then I'd have to look at this and say, well, you know, I'm sorry, this looks good, but it's wrong, forget about this. You know, it's easier if I fix language bugs. Okay. If you do use local cache, you can do this in a config file just by saying, I want to use local cache, I want to have items cached locally. You could do this in config or in code. More often it's done in code because it allows you to choose for every single item which you retrieve if you want to have it locally or not. So if you look at local caching, and I've got a second application for local caching, this is a Windows application now. Just because I wanted to show you that this is not really limited to web environments. You could also use this in a Windows application. It's the same thing. You specify a certain cache name, put a value in there. And in my case, I can specify whether or not I want to use a local cache. How am I making this decision? In my system, I'm just going to... Oops, let me just zoom this a bit. Okay. I don't use code-based configuration. I don't use config-based configuration of the cache. Instead, I'm using code-based. And to use this code-based, I don't just say X is new data cache factory like we did before, but I pass in a configuration object. And in my configuration object, I specify a few things like, is there a timeout? Do I want to use notifications? Which servers do I use for this cache? And do I want to use a local cache or not? And based on the checkbox, I use one of two factories. I use a remote factory, a remote-only factory, or I use a local cache factory in addition. So and the rest is really just the same as before. It's really just about configuration. And if I do this, let's just put in a few items. I'm not using local cache now. I'll put in the item test key, and I'll put the item test key too. First request always takes a bit longer when the caching infrastructure is set up. So I put in test key and test key 2. I'll get this item again. Yes, it's really stored in my system. And if I run multiple gets now without a local cache, I run a few gets, and you'll see that 1,000 get operations took 500 milliseconds. This is not a real-world data. This is running on my virtual machine, running on the same box, no network in between, but it's sharing the same hardware. So these are not numbers which you can use as a starting point for your calculation. These are totally wrong numbers. But they are just relative to what you're seeing next. If I use the local cache, I can get the same item from my local cache. And if I run this in a performance test, it will be substantially faster. On a remote machine, the difference will be even higher. Because now I don't have any serialization, deserialization. So I'm trading off the performance versus staleness of data by using local cache. Okay. To use local cache, you can also activate notifications. These are change notifications. You can subscribe for one item, and you'll get an information when the item has changed. Or you can specify that you want to look for any change in the whole cache. So what I could do is I could start a second instance of our Windows application. And these are the two applications. In the first one, I'll add a notification for the item test key 2. That's just an item notification. If I put something in there which is not test key 2 from my other application, the first application doesn't notice anything. But if I put item test key 2 into the cache, the first application will get information that this item has been replaced in my global cache. This is also used by local caching. So in local caching, you can configure that you want to be notified whenever an item is changed on the server side, which you currently have in your local cache. And your server will notify the client. This is not really a callback notification. This is done using polling. The server will just keep a list of changes, and the client will poll in configurable intervals and will say, well, has anything changed for me? And you can configure the queue length, etc. Notifications are also quite easy to develop. If you just look at this, and there will be a button, add notification. Only if Visual Studio is nice to me. Otherwise, there won't be one. Normally, this is the time when you'll get the Visual Studio is busy icon on the bottom of the screen. I could now use this time to say that, you know, it's just a beta version. But I assume you've heard this one before. Okay. Ah, here we go. No, right now, actually, Visual Studio is pretty good in the performance. The problem here is really my caching infrastructure in the back end. I'm running way too many virtual machines. Okay. I'm really running way too many virtual machines now. I should change this demo to only have two virtual machines. Okay, so button add cache notification. Here we go. And it's really just a case of you take your cache using this factory, and then you call add cache level callback, and you specify which operation you want to call on. This is now a cache level notification, and you can say, well, I want to be called whenever an item is added or removed or replaced, for example. And then you'll get a callback. The last parameter is a callback method, which will then be invoked whenever this item is changed. Okay. These are notifications. And let's switch back to PowerPoint. Then there are... I need to change this to run on fewer VMs. Okay, so we have notifications. This is notification needs to be enabled on the cache config. When you create a cache, you have to specify notifications enabled is true to allow for cache notifications. You have, in addition to doing just put and get, you have optimistic and pessimistic locking as well, or pessimistic concurrency handling. You can go to an item, and if you want to have optimistic locking, or well, optimistic concurrency detection, not locking. Oh, it's gone again. Thanks. Oh, Windows is telling me something. Nope. I don't really want to change the color. Let's keep. Okay. So you call get, and as an overload, you can get a data cache item version object in addition to the get. This will contain a version ID. And if you call a put later on or use a put later on, you can just pass the version back to the cache, and the cache will then determine if this is still current or if somebody else has made a change for the same item in the meantime, which means that you get an exception here. During optimistic locking, you get the exception on update. If you want to use pessimistic locking, you can use get and lock. And get and lock will get the item, lock it, and you get a lock handle as an odd parameter, and you will then use this lock handle in put and unlock. And in put and unlock, you just again unlock this. Here you would get the exception in this line. If you try to get an item which is currently locked and you can't get the lock, then you would get the exception here. So basically you can determine or decide where you want to lock. Something which is quite interesting is that velocity comes, or fabric caching comes with a session state provider. This allows you to register, just by using this, this piece of code, this allows you to register a session state provider in your web config. And whenever you access your session, just like you do today without any code changes, this session information will be stored in velocity. That's very, very simple. There's a very simple way to use velocity, use AppFabric caching for existing servers or services.
Is the same for ASP.NET caching?
It's the same for ASP.NET caching, not for session state. So there is a cache provider in the works. It was supposed to be live already, but I think it's not yet in beta 2. There are definite plans. So I'm not really working for Microsoft, so I can't say if this cache provider will ship in the final version, but I definitely assume that it will, because that's one of the key scenarios. Also an output caching provider, for example, just for purely doing output caching. Okay. And then the missing link is high availability. What happens if you have items which you cannot lose, which you cannot recover from a database? And that's where high availability comes into play. High availability, as of beta 2, is unfortunately only available on Enterprise Edition operating systems, not on Standard Edition or Web Edition OS. I don't know if Microsoft changes the spec, because until beta 1, high availability was usable on all systems. But in this case, what you'll have is whenever you store an item, the item will be duplicated. There will be a primary and a secondary copy of an item, which will be stored on different servers. So for every item you store, it will store multiple copies. And as soon as a node fails, it will then determine, well, the fact that the node has failed will turn the secondary copy into a primary copy, and it will immediately create additional secondaries and move them again to different servers. So it basically guarantees you that whenever only one node fails, you will be able to recover your data. So the only situation where you could lose data would be if two nodes fail within the same time frame before the data has been copied. But that's the standard case for every kind of replication scenario. If you want to use high availability, you also have to specify this during the cache configuration. You can specify how many secondary copies you want. As of the current beta version, only one secondary is supported. I don't know what the current plans are, because there originally were plans which would support more than one secondary copy, so that you can limit the exposure again. In the new cache command, you can also specify cache eviction and cache expiration policies. You can define the fact that you don't want to have your items be expired after a certain time frame, and you don't want items to be evicted on memory pressure. So these items would now be guaranteed to stay alive no matter what happens to the memory of the server, etc. Normally, if you happen to hit the memory boundary, your items will be removed from the cache. Okay, and in the last 75 minutes, you've seen what AppFabric gives you. And this is Windows Server AppFabric. That's not Azure AppFabric, obviously. That's something which you run in your data centers. It gives you hosting capabilities for WCF and workflow, including persistence tracking and monitoring, and of course the whole configuration for IT pros. That's AppFabric hosting. And then you have AppFabric caching, which used to be called Velocity, and I think I might have said this, or this might have slipped a few times, this cache, code name Velocity. And Velocity gives you this distributed caching. And you've seen things like the name caches, the regions. We have only briefly looked at tagging, so you can tag items and return all the items which have a specific tag. You've seen local caching, the high availability features, et cetera, et cetera. And one thing which I think is particularly important is the session state provider. I've only shown it quite briefly because it's so small and you only put it in your config file. But this allows you to take AppFabric caching and put it into your web application without any changes, as long as all your cached items are serializable, of course, which would be the main limitation. But this would also be the case if you'd use SQL Server-based session store today. And with this, I'd like to thank you for being here, and I hope that I could give you a brief overview of what AppFabric will do for you. And as of the current plans, AppFabric will be released in Q2, or well, rather Q3 of 2010, and you might want to look into this. The beta 2 is available right now on MSDN. Thank you very much.